There's a little wooden...
I went down there in '88.
Between...
To get a job. When I first moved in town, there was a little finishing shop in there. And I was living in the brick church there. So there was an ad in the paper, wanted somebody. I got up in the morning before 7 o'clock and went down there, and there's a fellow ahead of me. His name was Morehouse, I remember. I'll never forget it. Afterwards, he became a shoe clerk up on Main Street.
In 1891, C.M. Horch was still on Stevens Lane, D.E. Lowy on River Street, Mallory on Beaver Street, Meath on Center Street, Meeker Brothers on Canal Street, Merritt on 436 Main Street, T.C. Millard on Rowan Street, and Nickel Hines and Mool, M-O-U-L, had become Nichols and Mool.
Well, that was the George McLaughlin's first shop, no.
Down the swamp?
Down the swamp.
This address is given as Extension Canal.
What used to be Clark's Box Shop at one time. Clark's Box Shop was the end of Canal Street one time.
Is that now Hobson and Box, or is...
No, just the side,
side of Hobson.
That's McLaughlin's part of it.
H. Partrick and Son, 37 Packyoak Avenue.
That's where the solid recovery plant is. Higson had a hot shop in there.
You just spoke of that place. They make spoons there now.
Hobson and Botts.
That's the shop that Harry McLaughlin
had one time.
Harry was in there before he went up to Rowan Street.
Yeah,
that's right.
Too far.
Ratchford and Lee, Taylor Street near Chestnut. Now that's probably Frank Lee's.
Well, I was in there.
He started in Bethel, did he not?
He started.
Well, Lee Hawley and Ratchford, you started down there. Remember Lee Hawley and Ratchford?
Yes.
Well, Frank Lee and my father-in-law used to work in Bethel. So he said to Jim, he says one day...
That was Jim Costello.
He says, Jimmy says, I'm going in business. Will you go in with me? Jim was working for Hickok. He had a good job at that time. And he had charge of the blocking room, and he used to hire the blockers, see? And he used to get so much, you know, but he'd hire the blockers. It was kind of a contract job with him. So he says, no, he says, but I'll help you in every way I can. And they used to go down to that shop and block hats on a Sunday. When they went with Lee Hawley Ratchford, and they cracked up afterwards.
Lee and Martin Lawler one time cleaned out an old shop in Bethel. Lee run it. Martin says, we even cleaned out the old tire. What do you think of that? They cleaned out the old tire. Lee had a number of chances. Over in Mill Plain he run a shop, you know that?
Who?
Frank Lee.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know that.
Yes, Jack McDonald worked for him. You know how they used to get paid when they'd do their work? Lee said, I haven't got the check this week. Then when he'd get the check, he'd tell them to down in front of the bank and he'd pay them off. They wouldn't have much coming. That was when he was in Mill Plain. That McDonald only died here about five years ago in Fall River. He must have been 100 years old. He used to come here about every 4 or 5 years to see his brother George.
Well, Rundle and White were still operating in 1891 on River Street.
They run a loose.
Scott had disappeared from Washington Avenue, but J.R. Spain and Company shows up on Railroad Avenue near DeLay.
I was around where
Tommy Spain's people?
Tommy Spain's father. He was a finisher. Had a finishing shop there. That was
quite a shop there, too.
Had Danbury Rough Hat.
Another new one that showed up.
Who run that place afterwards, you know, was a box shop.
That's right.
Fred Hines.
That's right.
Another name that showed up in 1891 is Taylor Brothers, quite beyond Triangle.
Well, those are the ones that made the machine. The Taylor sizing machine.
Yeah, Taylor sizing machine. They also ran a hat shop.
They
were the Taylor Opera House family and later built the Capitol Theater.
That's right.
James H. Townsend, 22 River Street, is a fairly new one in 1891. Charles F. White, 14 River Street.
That was Rundle and White.
Now, Rundle and White is 9 to 27 River. This is across the street of Charles F. White at 14 River in 1891.
Uh-huh.
And then White, Tweedy and Smythe, S-M-Y-T-H, had replaced the Tweedy Manufacturing Company at 32 Rose Street. And M. Zuern, Z-U-E-R-N, and company at 10 Bank Street is listed as a hat manufacturer.
Well, he was on Center Street once.
And Matt Zuern.
Matt Zuern.
Yes. That's Charlie Kitt's, let me see. Matt Zuern's wife was Charlie Kitt's aunt, I think.
He was the special policeman who used to be in the Capitol Theater. His daughter was Gladys Kitt, Mary Ernie Miller in Bethel, who's now a banker in New Milford.
Is that who? Is that why?
Now, I'm going to have to change this.
They used to live in the house when I lived on McDermott Street. They lived upstairs.
You've been taken all up.
I hope so. If it hasn't taken it down, I'm going to be very disappointed. But we're getting near the end of this spool. You mean to say
that's been on all the way?
That's been on all the time.
For heaven's sake.
Now, what I want to do after we change the spool is discuss strikes, and particularly the Lowy situation. And also, we got to really do credit to Jack Walker and get some of his contributions to the hatting industry.
Remember the funny name. He named this guy.
Were you around when Jim Maher shut down D.E. Lowy's?
Well, I wasn't working at the trade then. No,
he went up in Scotland. That was the cause of all the trouble. He stopped them up, and all that material was there in the process of manufacturing.
You know, the only non-union shop in Danbury, Meyer wanted to turn it union. That was a long story short, isn't it?
Yeah.
D.E. Lowy hit a snag.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get into D.E. Lowy.
And that's the reason why, if they had continued on and finished up that work, you know, that was in the course of a process, you know.
You know, he died.
That suit would have never taken place.
You know, he died broke.
Oh, D.E. Lowy?
Yes.
Oh, here I do. But he had a pension.
He told me one day when Sweeney was building his trestle work up there.
Yes, because I was associated with him all along.
Dee, you were mentioning something that C.D. Parks told Luke Sweeney. That's Luke Sr.
Yeah, I was with him. We got talking about Luke. He's practically blind. Parks says, do you know that he's broke? The Manufacturers Association throughout the state, they used to donate around $4,000 or $5,000 a year to keep it. Merritt got all that money, you know.
That's Walter Gordon Merritt.
Yeah.
Of course, he's written a book which discusses the Hatter strike, and the Hatter strike has been
that made him
the subject of many treatises, articles, and what have you. But what do the men who were involved, for instance, Tom McNally, who was a boy working in the D.E. Lowy Company, which is factory is now the back part of the Mallory plant
off
Rose Hill, off of Rose Street. Tom, what do you recall of the strike? One thing I'd like to ask, did the men work on a sort of a contract basis?
No, same as any other shop.
One note I picked up was that George Bratton was a foreman or had some position there. And that he hired the men who worked under him, and he worked on contract with Lowy. Was that common throughout the shop, or is that in just one department?
Well,
I don't know where it could be. I worked as a roundman boy in the fax shop in the sizing department. My brother Eddie worked on a pinning out machine. The pinning out machine is after the hat was sized, they put them on this machine and squeeze the water out of them before they put them upstairs to dry. And the day of the strike, I knew nothing about it, and nobody else. The foreman was Al Ackerman. He lived up on the Mallory Street. And his son worked there too, Frank. And we knew nothing about it. And they came in, and Meyer, or I don't remember anybody coming in there. But all I remember was that somebody said, there's a strike, and we're going to meet down on White Street. That was enough. And I remember Al Ackerman taking off his canvas apron and laying it down on the bench. And I went upstairs to the dressing room and got my coat and hat. And I said to Mr. Ackerman, I said, are you going? He said, yes. He says, I'm going with the men.
He was the foreman.
He was the foreman.
He was going out on strike with the rest of them.
He was going with the men. And Louis came in, and he was crying.
This is Dietrich E. Lowy
himself. And he says, I don't know what it's all about. And he says, I wish you you wouldn't go.
He was in tears, you said?
Yes, he was crying. And so we all went down. And down on White Street, it was the old Concordia Club, more of an Arians. There they used to have on the second floor, it was a two-story building. And they had athletic society there, rings and horses and everything. And that's where we we held our meetings. And John Moffat said to me one day, he said, I see you around here, young fellow. He says,
John Moffat was president of the
International
of the United Hatters of North America.
That's right.
I was at the convention when we broke him.
Yeah. And he said, I see you around here. He says, every day, he says, what do you do? Well, I said, I worked up there. I said, a rounder in the sizing department.
You were a boy rounding hats. That was opening them up after they had been sized?
No, cutting the edge off.
Oh.
They put them on a machine and it goes in under a knife and it circles around and makes the hats uniform. You set the machine, we say, at 9 inches. Every hat would be 9 inches deep because there's a spool was set here and the hat would go up against it and the brim would go around it and cut it off. And
this was on a rough hat body.
No, they sized them all the way through.
This was a finished.
No, this was the sizing hat.
Was Lowy a complete shop or just
the
back
way
shop?
Through.
All the way through.
In other words, he produced the hat from the handful of fur to the finished product.
That's right. So I said to him, Moffat, I said, I'm out on strike with the men. He said, well, he says, you're too young. I said, I'm not too young. He said, if it's not good enough for the men, it's not good enough for me. So he said, well, he said, thank God. He said, that's all right. He said, what do you expect to get out of it? He says, I expect to get registered.
Registered for what? Strike benefits or
no,
just
not strike benefits, just to be an apprentice.
Oh, I see. Registered as a union hatter.
That's right.
This was a strike for what amounts to union recognition.
That's right. Sure. That's right. And he said, "Are you? Who's here with you?" I said, "Well, there's only one fellow here with me." I said, "That's my brother, Ed." I said, "He was pinning out, and we both came out together."
He was a hatter.
A hatter too, and my
Did
father
he stay
was
in hatting.
Huh?
Did he stay in Hatting?
Yes, until he was put in the police department.
Oh, he became Lieutenant McGowan in the police department prior to his retirement.
Remember the time he got the appointment?
That's right.
His daughter married George Mannion?
That's right, his daughter, Catherine. And
he was a nurse.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he says, I don't know what I'm going to do with you. He says, well, I said, I know what I'm going to do with you. I said, I know what I'm going to do. I said, my father's always been a union hatter. And I said, I couldn't work in there.
Was Lowy operating as what they call an open shop with union men and non-union men both?
Right, that's right.
And one thing that has come up, or one thing that I've run across, Lowy was quite active in what was then the German Lutheran Church, now the Emanuel Lutheran Church.
Could be.
A large number of the crew were also active
in the church. I would say 95% of them were German.
And most of them fellow churchgoers with him.
That's right.
But nonetheless, in spite of their close religious association, they went out on strike.
There was only two, I think, out of the whole crew that stayed, and one of them was Irish. He wasn't German at all, and that was Gilday.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Gilday on...
I know.
You know who I mean?
She runs a boarding house.
That's right, Mrs. Gilday, Al Conley's father-in-law.
That's right.
He lived on
Library Place.
He died,
you know?
That's right, huh?
She's still alive.
Yeah.
She was up at Glen Hill until recently. I don't know where she is now.
Uh-huh.
Well, that strike.
Well, I stayed down out anyway, and I finally got registered out.
As a union hatter.
And my brother got registered. And we both went to work down to the National Hat. He went down there, he went to learn sizing without spending any other time. Only if they needed him for pinning out, he'd go in and pin out. I went back on the job that I had up to Louis Rounding Hats, and George Wixon was a foreman.
That was generally known as the Lowy Hat Company rather than the Lowy.
Wasn't I president then?
No.
No?
I don't know.
I had a lot of trouble down in that shop.
Oh, yes, you did. But
was it always pronounced Lowy?
I've heard of both Lowy and Louie.
Was it?
But we always called it
Lowy.
Well, you know that the neighbors, old John Dyer and some of them owned their own home, they lost them.
Well, I have heard it said that no one ever lost.
They didn't lose. They lost them through the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
so I said the decision was against them, but there was an agreement made whereby that they didn't lose them because of the American Federation of Labor.
The AFL got into the case, of course, and that led
them. They were in it all the time. You know how they pay that off? 1 hour's work.
Well, we'll get to that point in a minute, but when the strike started, it was what year, 1902?
Well, I'd say 1902 or 1901.
1902. Now, the case went into the Supreme Court because the United Hatters declared a boycott against Lowy, a secondary boycott, and in brief, the decision finally rendered by the Supreme Court was that a union could be sued under the Sherman Antitrust Act, which led to Congress adopting the Clayton Act, which exempted unions from a suit such as Lowy brought.
That's right.
And tripled the damage.
Well, that was the damage.
Triple damages to Lowy on the suit, or on any antitrust action. But the, of course, the case is very significant in many ways, but what about the men themselves? You mentioned that you went on strike, you and your brother went to work at the National. Uh-huh. Is that what happened with most of the Lowy Hatters?
Most of them all got shot someplace else.
And did Lowy continue operating at all, or what was the situation?
He tried to, and then he petered out after a few years. I won't say how many, I just don't remember how many, but I don't know, I couldn't tell you now. One fella that went in, I couldn't tell you one. That went back in there.
Back into
because
Lowy.
A lot of those fellows that came out of there were never union men. And that was the only place they could work. There are Merritts, which was also an open shop. And by going into the union, well, then they could work in many places on in Danbury, Bethel, or New Milford, or Fall River, not Fall River.
Any union shop.
Any union shop, no matter where it was, Philadelphia, no matter where it was. And that was what appealed to them, that they weren't confined to one place. They were bringing up families, and their employment wasn't any too much good to them because they only could work in one shop. That was why they never went back there.
Now, was there any real suffering among the employees of Lowy because of the strike in the years, in the early years before it got into this long court wrangle?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say that it was. I would say the only thing that they ever feared was the fact that they were liable to lose their home.
The attachments had been placed on their property because of their participation in the strike.
Because they were members of an organization and they were responsible for the actions of the officers of the organization.
Who was the National president at that time?
At that time, John Moffat was president. And Jimmy Meyer was vice president. And
Shelvoy.
Frank Shelvoy of New Jersey was Martin Lawler was secretary of treasury.
Of course, it was known as Lowy versus Lawler et al.
Yeah, well, that's right, because
Lawler had the check that he paid Lawler that day in the office.
Paid Lawler.
The label was registered in the
paid Lawler Garden Mayor down in the town clerk's office. We all looked at the check. So Mike went down, and he said, here to Merritt, take your blood money. He said, Merritt near hit the ceiling. No,
this was in the town clerk's office in Danbury?
Yes, in Danbury.
And he had to release the attachments on the homes of the Hatters in order to get the check to settle the lawsuit.
That's right.
Now the Hat Trimmers Union, they were involved in the hat makers and the hat finishers, I assume.
Yeah, the whole organization.
In 1899, which was just shortly before the strike, the Hat Makers Association president was Jane Marr. The vice president, Henry Lepper, he was later deputy registrar of voters, the Republican registrar, I believe.
No, Democrat.
A Democratic registrar, I'm sorry. His daughter, I believe, married Arnold Osmond, who worked for me one time. Secretary Patrick H. Conley, Treasurer Albert B. Hoyt. The Hat Finishers, President Charles J. Barrett, Vice President Henry F. May, Secretary Hugh C. Shelvoy, Treasurer William Humphreys. Of course, Huey Shelvoy was Secretary of the Finishers, I guess, until
Christmas, I don't know how many years. Wow. Nobody will ever tie him.
And the Hat Trimmers Union, President Mrs. Ellen M. Foote, Vice President Miss Julia Moore, Secretary Miss Kitty Smith, Treasurer Miss Lizzie Wildman.
Had Ellen Foote, her husband, run the town farm there.
She was a head there for years and years.
Now, when the Lowy men were out on strike, none of them, you say none of them, as far as you know, went back in working for Lowy.
Not that I know.
And he had two men who stayed there, and of course, could he hire any other Hatters? Did any people come in from out of town Strike Breakers of Mike Paul?
They must have, because he continued to operate a little.
For
whether
two
they
years?
Saved him from Fall River or not, I don't know.
Them days, you know, Steve, down in Jersey, they said Union had to go to a place like that just to spoil the work, cut him, finish him. We done that in a movie.
D.E. Lowy Company is still listed on River, is listed on River Street in 1909 directory. That Lowy plant, though, is really off Rose Street, isn't it?
Well, that's
it's off of Rose Street. It's not on River.
Still there. It looks just the
yes.
same now as it did then.
Mallory used
Mallory.
It as storage.
Mallory bought that years and years ago. They used that for stock room.
Now, as a new member of the union, were you fired up with enthusiasm for the Lowy strike, or?
Well, it didn't require that. It was just that you had a meeting maybe every other day. You attended a meeting, and of course, me being young, that I used to enjoy myself there on the trapeze and on the dumbbells and the swinging clubs. And of course, some of the hatters would go downstairs. There was a tavern downstairs. And
what part of White Street was this?
About where the bridge was. Just the little side of the bridge.
On which side? The north?
On the right hand side. That was where the meetings were held.
Is that the block that burned out later on?
I wouldn't say that it was. I'd say
it wasn't the Holly block. We're seeing the lynches now, was it?
No, it wasn't the Holly block. It was the next block.
Beyond National Park.
Beyond the two. There was always in the Holly block, I don't know how about today, but there always was a dance room in there, a dance floor and everything else. And at one time, there's a wide stairs leading up to it where they used to hold dances. Do you remember that, George? About four doors from I Street.
Yes, I think Frank Scollum, I think, had a place room up there one time.
Could be.
What did Scollum have there?
Yeah, I think there's one back stairs.
Yes. You gentlemen were well acquainted with all the poker joints in town?
Oh, they were scattered all over. They were
illegal?
Oh, sure.
Swear they were.
But you had fun.
Well, some once in a while, you know, they would knock one off.
Scollum had the excitement. Somebody else had a poker game but him.
Not a big one. They were any number of small games, you know, but I think the Scollum's was a dollar limit.
Yeah, he was on the roof.
Scollum's.
Oh, well, not, but he didn't have any table stakes or anything like
that. Oh, yeah, sure. Yes, fair week, sure.
Well, fair week for that, but for the ordinary Saturday night fellas,
yeah.
Like you and George
now,
and the rest of you.
Wouldn't want us fellas to play with the fake instead of poker. No,
no.
He'd say,
you know, they made a habit, you know. A lot of drummers, you know, back years ago, when you had to travel around town by horse and wagon, you'd hire a rig, you know, in one of the livery stables to make your rounds around town. And a lot of the drummers, you know, they used to stop off weekends here in Danbury, just in order to, some of them used to love to play pool, you know. We had a lot of pool sharks here.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to play pool, you know, and then they used to play, they loved to play poker. They had stud games, you know, table stakes, March 6th had run into hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
But I remember, now what, hatters for recreation, they didn't have television, didn't have radios.
No.
Oh.
They did enjoy the poker games when they got into them, I gather, from
and
what
most
they
most of the time they didn't have money.
Hey, Steve, they came downtown every night. There was nothing to keep them at home. And they worked all day in the shop, and then they'd take it after supper, they'd take a walk downtown and probably wind up
them,
down. In
them days, they get a big glass of beer for a nickel and ten cents for a whiskey. Mustang Marin and them fellas used to send down to Johnny Collins's every noon. We had a dang big pail of beer and bring it in the shop.
Is that where the term Rushing the Growler came?
No, Rushing the Growler was universal. A fellow worked all day and the wife worked all day too at home, raising the kids and doing her family work. And when he came home, she was tired. Well, they'd have supper, and then he'd get the pail, and he'd take a walk to the saloon.
He'd
come down with the pail filled with beer. And then he and the wife and whoever happened to be in there would have a glass of beer.
at home.
At home, there on State
Street. At the Russell McGraw.
No, I'm touched.
Sure, they say the beer was...
That didn't work at all.
Well, they're panhandlers.
They were just panhandlers, and they get a pail somewhere, and they go down Cosmopolitan Park, which is in back of the courthouse, and they get down under the trees. That's one of the places.
Elmwood Place has now been cut through there.
No, Park Place.
Or Park Place, I'm sorry.
That's right. That was quite a place at one time.
Yes, yes.
Cosmopolitan Park.
That's had right.
Between Main Street and Town Hill.
That's right.
We had a parish priest here. He abolished that, didn't he, Father
Oh,
Leach?
He put the, yes, Father Leach, you know, he put
the... That was Henry Leach?
Yeah. He went to work on it from that
time. He was the first permanent rector. The priest wanted to hold the title permanent rector.
That's right.
Well, that brings up another subject. All you gentlemen seem to be of Irish extraction. George, are you Irish also?
Well, yes.
We were separate.
Well, I tell you, I'm a mixture. My grandparents on my father's side were German, and my grandparents on my mother's side were Irish.
That's rather a common combination.
Yeah, and but my
here.
Parents on both sides were American born.
But when you men went into Hadding, were the Irish who had moved into Danbury, they pretty much got into Hadding, or were there?
95%.
The sizers,
95% of the sizers were Irish descent.
No, they were not.
95% of the finishers were Yankees.
It was pretty hard to get into the Hadding trade at one time.
You bet.
You had to have quite a drag. Do you know how I got into the Hadding trade?
You mentioned John Green's sister.
I mentioned John W. Green's half sisters. That's his grandfather, you know.
The sizers, you say, were mainly Irish.
Yes,
the finishers were mainly Yankees.
That's right.
Where did the Germans come in?
The Germans came in both in the sizing and in the finishing end of it.
Now, when you say sizing, you're talking about...
The back shop.
The back shop in general, not just Taylor sizers.
No, just the back shop in general, bringing it up to a point where it went over to the finisher to be completed.
Well, it wasn't all Taylor machines, you know. They used to have a Jennings machine. Machine that was used.
They had a wearing machine.
The Taylor had one all of his own.
But the Taylor machine was the best of all.
Oh, yes.
It was the best because you operated with your hand, where the other ones, you kicked them with your foot, and at the end of the day, it must have developed quite a few hernias, too, because you'd come up with your foot down all day long, like that, and get your right in here. And up through here. But the tape machine, you just come down with your hand.
They were working in an atmosphere of water and hot water and steam all the time.
That's
right.
Did the hatters, makers such as you or the finishers, were they active in local politics?
Yeah.
Most of the mayors of the early years of the city succeeded the borough in 1889, they seemed to be from the manufacturing element, which was common in all early Connecticut cities.
Well, you say, do we become active in politics? That isn't running, is it?
Yes.
Oh, it is running. Well, the reason why is because I didn't want to be told, because I didn't want to blow my own horn.
Well, this is the reason I got it running, so we'll get this information down before it's lost to posterity.
Well, this won't be lost to posterity, because I'm talking to myself when you say we went into politics, because I did go into politics. When I came off the road for the Hatters, I went into the common council.
You're a councilman.
Yeah. And I served probably 12 years.
From which ward?
From the 4th ward.
The 4th ward.
I was a councilman from there. I was the alderman from there. I served on three committees.
Did you precede Ben Flanagan as alderman?
No, they came in after me. I followed Jim Relvin on Stone Street. As alderman.
Big Jim.
And
Dorothea Melvin Curtin.
That's